Our next case is 13-1048, Transtar Electric versus AEM Electric Services Corporation. Mr. Silk?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jim Silk. I'm here on behalf of AEM Electric Services. The facts of this case are very straightforward, and I'll briefly go through them. Transtar and AEM entered into a subcontract agreement. AEM was the general contractor. Transtar was a subcontractor. And this was for a project in Maumee, Ohio, construction of a hotel. For several invoices that Transtar submitted to AEM, they were paid. The last couple of invoices, I believe, that totaled approximately $44,000 were not paid by AEM because AEM was not paid by the owner. And that's where this dispute rises. And the basis for AEM not paying these invoices that were submitted is set forth in Section 4 of the subcontract agreement. And that section reads, receipt of payment by contractor from the owner for work performed by subcontractor is a condition precedent to payment by contractor to subcontractor for that work. And that language in the agreement was capitalized and bolded. And that's the issue of this case. Transtar is claiming that that provision is what's called a pay when paid provision. AEM's claiming that that provision is a pay if paid. And the trial court determined that AEM's position was correct, that it was a pay if paid provision. The appellate court reversed that and determined that it was a pay when paid.
Well, counsel, this is a new issue to me, and when I read your contract language, it seemed straightforward. Then when I read the Court of Appeals discussion, in which they indicate a pay if paid is not encouraged, and that pay when paid is really the way this should be interpreted. Is that, do I have it right or do I have it backwards?
No, I agree. I think that
and that they said that's the industry standard.
What I would say is that courts have strictly construed these provisions, without a doubt. But I would also say is that courts that have looked at this specific language where it says it's a condition precedent.
Well, how do we know what the norm is? We have to look to the lawyers, I guess, to tell us what they understand the norm in the industry is in looking at language like this.
And I think that's part of it. I think part of it is looking at other cases. There was a 10th District case, Evans et al. Versus Triad Architects, that addressed this very issue, and the 6th District exhaustively went through the Evans analysis and at the end of the day disagreed with the Evans analysis and said, the Evans analysis said, yeah, if you have this language, condition precedent.
Well, no, I'm not asking you what other judges who don't do this work think the norm is. You obviously represent contractors and the lawyers on the other side do, so I'm asking you an honest take on what's the norm in the industry.
My honest take would be that this is a standard provision in construction contracts, and that the parties.
Well, I understand it's a standard provision. How is it normally interpreted? That's what we're here about.
As far as it goes, it allocates the risk from the general contractor to the subcontractor for non-payment. And that's the reason you have this provision in the agreement, is to allocate that risk.
And the Court of Appeals said this is not sufficient language to give notice to the appellee here that there's an allocation, a reallocation of the risk. And that's the question here. Does the language that you put in the Section 4, subsection C, in bold, suffice to put the subcontractor on notice that there has been a shift in the allocation of risk here, and they are assuming the risk that if the general contractor doesn't get paid, they're not going to get paid?
Your Honor, that's exactly the issue. And obviously our position is that it specifically says condition precedent. It's bold.
Well, yeah, receipt of payment by contractor from the owner for work performed by subcontractor is a condition precedent to the payment. by contractor to subcontractor for work. But the appellate court would add, and there is a shift of the, you know, risk here, and I guess your position is, obviously, that anybody that understands English, anybody that reads this contract, it is standard. It is a provision that is inserted by agreement of the parties in maybe not every contract, but in contract, subcontractor contracts. So it's a known clause, and this is sufficient.
Yes, that's exactly our position, Your Honor.
Mr. Silk, do you have any knowledge of boilerplate that would add language regarding risk additional to what is in your contract?
Your Honor, not from personal experience, I've never seen any case law that had that additional language where it says a condition precedent and we're also allocating the risk from, again, I think other cases have said that this language in itself is pretty apparent that that allocation of risk is going to be transferred. And again, these are sophisticated parties. These are, you know, both contractors or businesses. It's not, you know, a lay person.
And is there a usual or often used paragraph that would encompass the paid or the pay when paid language understanding? In other words, if you say the language that is inserted in this contract clearly is to be used for a pay if paid situation, are there other clauses that could have been inserted that, you know, both parties had at their fingertips to say clearly that you would be, that the subcontractor only had to wait until the contractor was paid and then payment would be flowing and there was no shift of the risk?
Yes, Your Honor. Many of the cases cited by both parties, and some of these are Ohio cases, found that the provisions were pay when paid. And generally they have language that indicates that it must be paid, you know, within seven days.
Exactly. Or that sort of thing.
Yes.
And you think that is an important distinction here, that there is no time that is incorporated into your Section 4 subsection C language?
Yes, I think that's one of the critical elements that courts look at, yes.
Isn't the Court of Appeals really saying that this language, while you're saying as a lawyer that represents contractors, you understand it, probably the people at that table next to you, they probably understand it. But I'm trying to understand it this morning. If you have a clause that say pay if paid, does that mean if I don't get paid, neither do you?
That is correct.
I owe you nothing even though you've done all this work at my behest. I owe you nothing.
Well, it's really for the owner's behest, generally. You know,
is that true? A subcontractor comes on a job, is he working for the owner, or does he have a contractor say, be here at 7 o'clock, do this job, and you'll get paid?
Again, it probably depends on the job site, but the work that the subcontractor...
A bricklayer. Use it as a bricklayer. You're a contractor building a house. Does the bricklayer himself really care who owns that house? Because he never was hired by the homeowner, was he?
That is generally correct, although in this case, Transtar also did have a contract directly with the owner. So they had a contract with...
But we're talking about contract language here today. We don't really care about that. And I guess what I'm joining the Court of Appeals in saying, what's wrong with using plain English? If I don't get paid, neither do you.
And what I would go back to, Your Honor, is that, you know, our position, this is unambiguous, this is clear. It may not be written at a layperson's level or a high school level, but, you know, again, these are sophisticated entities. If we start going through every contract to see whether the language is too sophisticated.
So you're telling Justice Pfeiffer this is very clear and he should have understood it?
I'm sure you understood it.
I did understand until I read the Court of Appeals explaining to me why I shouldn't understand. But counsel, are you done?
I'm done.
You mentioned something else that makes this perhaps factually different. I gather from the Court of Appeals discussion the reason they say that such an interpretation as you're urging is disfavored is that generally the sub is not in privity with the owner of the business, correct?
And
would have no ability to collect for the unpaid account.
And Your Honor, I think...
Is that correct?
I think there's other ways they could collect unjust enrichment. I think that there's liens that could be placed, but I would agree that, you know, courts generally...
Okay, so now if you do an unjust enrichment, you got to come in and show the value of what you did and a whole set of complicated things that you weren't even keeping records on, I assume.
Well, I think the value of the services that they agreed to would probably be the best
determinant.
But
you said here Transtar had a contract with the property owner.
In this case, I think that's probably...
Does that make this case different?
No. I think the same outcome would be whether they had an agreement with the owner or not. I don't think that has any effect.
So Transtar, though, had an agreement that would have allowed them to sue directly for the unpaid bill?
Not for this contract, not with the contract it had with...
We're talking about a different contract. Well, then why would you mention it?
I was responding...
Doesn't seem relevant, does it?
I was trying to be responsive to a question.
Okay.
So I apologize if I went beyond that.
Mr. Silk, did you draft this language? Did your client draft this language?
Your Honor, I do not know. I came into
the
case.
Is it in the record someplace as to who drafted this language so we know which party to construe the contract against?
It was not in the language. It was not in the record. The trial court evidence was very sparse. It was an affidavit that we presented, and on the other side it was indication that bills were not paid. So
now,
there's no
is
evidence.
There a possibility that the subcontractor can file a material man lien for the work done or the materials put into this property in
Yes.
the construction of the hotel? Or was that done, to your knowledge?
It was not to my knowledge, but under 4113.62E, which is the Ohio Fairness and Contracting Act, was cited by the amicus parties, a subcontractor or any person can bring liens despite having this pay-if-paid language.
Is there a time limit on that?
I'm sure there's a time limit on bringing liens, yes.
Is that 60 days?
I believe so, but I'm not certain about that.
All right. What about public policy in our state? Has the case law or your research shown any public policy favoring or disfavoring pay-if-paid language in these kinds of contracts?
No. I mean, the only public policy I would suggest is that, you know, again, it's the freedom of contracting.
Pardon me?
The freedom of contracting and the ability of parties to be able to enter into these agreements. And if there's unambiguous language, they should be enforced in that light.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I don't believe I reserved, if I may reserve the last 2 minutes.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Liggett.
Thank you. Good morning. Luther Liggett for Transtar. I have with me the owner and president, Dan Bolden, along with amicus curiae, counsel Russell O'Rourke, on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors and the American Subcontractors.
Was this the first time you ever saw this type of a contract, counsel?
No, I see it all the time. And the theory the general contracting industry would like are magic words. It's alchemy, trying to turn lead into gold. And it fails for the most basic of all concepts, and that's what the Court of Appeals said. You must look at a meeting of the minds. What did the parties actually think they were agreeing to? Not some boilerplate that was stuck in, by the way, it was by AEM, a Minnesota company. We look at the choice of law says Minnesota law. That was just boilerplate photocopied and used for this Toledo project. The key is, if you're looking at a meeting of the minds, in this case, it was a lawsuit by the subcontractor on money damages. It is an affirmative defense by the general contractor to say, no, it's a bar. Therefore, the burden of proof is on the general contractor to show that this language, there was a meeting of the minds. And there are always two factual issues in this language. And I'm not here to say that you could not correctly write a sentence in which there is a meeting of the minds in some cases. We are not making that argument. But in this boilerplate kind of language, there's always two factual issues. Number one, what was the exact risk that they intended to shift? And number two, what were the operative facts that led to the non-payment?
So do we have a factual question?
Always.
Do we have a factual question in this case?
Oh, absolutely.
So we remand, we reverse summary judgment. Did your client also move for summary judgment? Did we have cross motions?
We had cross motions at the trial court, but the Court of Appeals, I think, foreclosed remand, because what they do is say, they stop and say, when you read the contract as a whole, you don't just read this one sentence through a straw. When you read the contract as a whole, it's clear there was no intent to shift the risk.
Mr. Liggett, though, the contract shows that this is in bold. It's in capital letters. Doesn't that tell everybody, this is really important, pay attention to this part of the contract?
Justice Lanzinger, it makes absolutely no difference. If you put the language, for instance, I think is telling, AEM subcontract also says that if the subcontract is not paid, AEM will pursue the owner or, in its option, allow Transtar to pursue the owner in its own name. What did it do? It did neither. It barred Transtar from seeking a remedy. And that's why we raised the issue of the unconstitutionality. They have effectively taken this sentence and said, we're going to go affirmatively and prevent you from a remedy. So one of the issues—
How did they do that?
Because they refused to prosecute the owner in their own name or allow us to do so.
I thought what I read was that they assured that they would go after the owner.
They did no such thing. And that's, again, this is very important. They did not interplead the entity. They infer that somehow they just don't have money. But that was the relevance of the other case. Transtar did some other work for the owner. Transtar was not paid. Transtar sued. Transtar collected. And Transtar filed a satisfaction of judgment. So we know in the record that the owner's not insolvent. What did AEM do to collect? Nothing.
Well, did they have a right, or did you have a right to proceed in the event that that AEM did not?
We do not, because the contract says it's in their discretion, and they chose to do nothing. They didn't interplead the owner in this case. They didn't sue them separately.
Have you asserted that contractual provision and ask them for that right?
We've argued that, but it's like, again, it's their defense, and that should have been their remedy to say, we're not going to sue them, you sue them. But the practicality in this industry, back to the industry practice, the practicality is that they don't want to sue owners. What they say in the affidavit, we weren't paid either. Really? They never put in the record how much that is, but I suspect it's 10%. It's the markup. They didn't collect. They collected everything but Transtar's payment plus their markup. So they walk away from the contract. And they're not going to sue the owner because they want more work. And they're not going to let us sue the owner because they want more work. That's the industry standard. And back to the equities of this case. What they want is a magic sentence in bold that they can always put in every boilerplate. And when, for whatever reason, the owner doesn't pay, the general can walk away. That's not fair, but that's what they are looking for. On the other side of the equities, we have subcontractors who have no control over these boilerplate contracts and are told that if for whatever reason the owner doesn't pay us, you're stuck. Now, there's two problems with that. Number one, if in fact, let's say in the perfect world, they had a negotiation and they came to a meeting of the minds that if the owner doesn't pay AEM for Transtar's work, Transtar doesn't get paid, then that subcontract fails for lack of consideration. It would have to be the meeting of the minds that you're doing work for free.
So, counsel, yes. In order to balance out this section that talks about condition precedent,
yes.
There had to have been another, in your mind, in the way you would want us to look at this entire contract, is there had to be a section that would allow for pursuit by the subcontractor of the owner in some fashion that would have stood in the shoes of the contractor.
That would be one manner you could rewrite this, except they already have that in, and simply—
Pardon me?
Except in this subcontract, they have that option and refuse to do either. So I think it goes beyond
They have the option to allow the subcontractor in the contract as written to stand in their shoes.
Yes. They refused to do so. They refused to plead the owner in. They refused to let Transtar do it.
Is that the only mechanism that would have allowed for Transtar to sue the owner?
That was it. And here's the other problem, of course, is 2305-31, that says you may not transfer your own negligence. So let's say in a perfect world—
You may not transfer what?
Your own responsibility, negligence. So let's say in a perfect world we have an agreement, we negotiate, and it says, now you understand— If the general doesn't get paid, you're not getting paid. I agree with that. Ohio law says that contract is unenforceable if AEM is culpable. So there's always a fact issue. Is AEM culpable?
I'm glad you brought that up because I'm confused on that point.
Yes.
In the trial court, there were cross motions for summary judgment.
Yes.
So your position in the trial court was there are no factual questions. Is that right?
No, that's not correct at all. Because we did assert that language. I said our first position, and again, in a summary judgment, it wasn't really an appellate argument. We were talking admissions and discovery.
Okay.
And the judge had not taken any position on making what we're here today about. So it was a much more basic proceeding. But no, the issue we raised at the trial court was even if you have a meeting of the minds that you're going to transfer all the risk, is still unenforceable. Because if, in fact, AEM is the reason the owner didn't pay, that cannot be transferred by law. That's void and unenforceable.
So you're saying that there can never be a paid, if paid, contract in Ohio. That's your position.
No, not quite. I'll take that statement. There can never be a pay if paid without at least two factual inquiries. What was the intent of what was the foreseeable risk that they intended to transfer, and what was the operative fact? Let me give you a hypothetical. If the reason, and we don't know because they didn't put on any evidence, if the reason that this owner didn't pay was the toilets didn't work, that's the plumbing contractor. The plumbing contractor works for AEM. That is, as to the electrical contractor, the plumbing contractor's liability and cannot be transferred under statute. So you always have to ask, why didn't the owner pay? We know it's not insolvency because we collected elsewhere. And so you have to ask, what's the operative fact? You also have to ask, did they intend to transfer that liability? What did they intend? And that's the Court of Appeals decision. When you look at this whole contract, it doesn't talk about what risk was foreseeable and transfer. And again, Justice Lanziger, if you said it's anything, that fails for the foreseeability test. How can he agree to something he has no idea what to expect? He has no control. That was Amicus's point. AEM's the only one in control. There's a language in the subcontract that says Transtar's not even allowed to talk to the owner.
Mr. Liggett, so I understand procedurally where we are. If we agree with your analysis, we would simply affirm and this does not go back.
I agree. I think that is the proper.
That's your analysis of the procedure.
Yes. If you wanted to take it one more step, and regardless of the Court of Appeals, I think the proposition of law is that consistent with Ohio and 50 states, there has to be a meeting of the minds of what the foreseeable risk was that was transferred, and there has to be a factual inquiry into the operative fact of why it wasn't paid.
Mr. Liggett, isn't there still a problem in this case, though? Because even if we agree with the Court of Appeals that this became a pay-when-paid case, they've never been paid. So when is the money due?
Under pay-when analysis,
yes.
In 50 states. By the way, there is an implication somehow that there's conflicts among the courts. There is no conflicts among the courts, including the Evans case, which says you have to look at the intent of the parties. And with very few exceptions, the courts say, and we can't tell that they transferred this risk, and you have to pay eventually. That's the pay when paid. It doesn't matter if the owner doesn't pay. At some point, as Justice Pfeiffer, I think, was saying, Transtar is working for AEM. He didn't know what the deal is with the other guy. And AEM ends up having to take that risk and pay. Another example in Ohio law, a surety bond. When a prime contractor must give a surety bond to the owner, that would intuitively be the owner's remedy, right? Not in Ohio. Ohio says even subcontractors can sue against that bond. And that's important. So the subcontractors don't know what the owner's deal is, don't know why the owner's not paying, and shouldn't have to worry. They're working for the general contractor.
So was there a surety bond here that the subcontractor can go against the contractor?
No, it's a private contract, and typically you don't see surety bonds.
Okay. So you said that this procedurally affirm and it doesn't go back.
Correct.
For a review, but you say the operative facts have never been developed in this case.
Two pieces. You have to have first a meeting of the minds.
So you want us to find that there was no meeting of the minds.
Right. That was the
okay, that's what I find difficult to okay. get to. But say that's the majority of the court doesn't get to the fact that and agree with you that there was no meeting of the minds.
Right.
The operative fact prong, how do you address that?
It's an affirmative defense. The AEM has to put on the record why the owner
they can't meet their obligation to
right.
go after the owner.
Yep, and why he didn't pay.
Okay, and that was never done.
They never bothered to put that in the record.
Okay, so why don't we, if we agree that in the state of Ohio you can have a paid, if paid, contract, and we have to look at both the foreseeable risk transferred and the operative facts, mm-hmm. and send it back to the trial court for a determination of the operative facts.
You could, but under Ohio precedent, and as the Court of Appeals did, the interpretation of contract is mixed fact and law. And I believe that the Court of Appeals is correct on the initial issue is you cannot determine from the four corners of the whole contract that they intended to transfer all risk. And if they did.
But if we get to the point where we disagree with the Court of Appeals on that, that's my point with
sure,
you.
Sure, I agree with you, Justice.
Then you agree that we should need to send it back.
You could.
So that the operative facts can be developed to see if mm-hmm. The contractor met their obligation for other parts of the contract to pursue the owner. And if they did not, mm-hmm. then it would void this pay if paid, and mm-hmm. the subcontractor could go after the contractor.
I think this court could find that. I don't think that's a correct finding because inherently what you're saying is a general statement that a general contractor puts into boilerplate is good enough for an unsuspecting.
But the scenario that I just mm-hmm. talked about would defeat what you said is the industry standard that subcontractors don't go after contractors because the language is
in there. That's not what I said. Generals don't go after owners.
Well, they don't go after owners,
right.
and the contractors generally don't go after owners because they want additional work.
Right, but subcontractors sue the generals all the time, and the subcontracts uniformly include this boilerplate that is never negotiated. There's never a meeting of the minds, and when we look at this subcontract, you can see, and I've got those in my brief, numerous provisions that are completely inconsistent. For instance, it says, if we stop the work midstream, Transtar gets paid that proportion. But if Transtar finishes the work, they don't get paid? That makes no sense. It makes no sense that...
Well, counsel, here we've got a case in answer to the chief. She's asking you directly what sort of a remedy you're seeking, or the appellate is seeking. The Court of Appeals has already handled that, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
I'm looking at their last sentence. It's remanded to the court, further proceedings, including the determination of a reasonable time for payment.
Right.
You win at that point.
Correct. It was not a remand for a factual determination. And the reason was, in the Court of Appeals, they found that in the four corners of the whole contract, there was no finding, there was no meeting of the minds of the foreseeable risk. And an example is, if you're going to do that, let's put ourselves in the general contractor's drafting pen. If you're going to do that, how do you handle 2305.31? How do you say, don't you have to say, except for when I'm negligent, except for when I'm liable? They don't do even that.
This language, you said, was fairly common. You see it all the time.
I do.
What's the industry understanding of what it means?
Pay when paid, you have a reasonable time.
That's what it means.
No subcontractor is, and this is Thomas Dyer, by the way.
It's what?
This is the Thomas Dyer case, which is 1962, nationally recognized. No subcontractor is signing a subcontract not intending to get paid. That's the truth.
General contractor signs a contract not intending to get paid either.
I understand, but we don't have any control over that relationship.
Right.
That's the problem.
Under 2305.32, I think you argued to us that we don't know if AEM is culpable Or is there any evidence in the record to show us their culpability in pursuing the owner?
Well, that's two different questions. Culpability, I meant regarding to why the owner didn't pay. Did AEM have any role in that? And it's their burden.
Is there?
As an affirmative defense, and they put nothing in the record. But the point about the second point you made is a separate point, and that is that AEM has to show us why the owner didn't pay in the first place, and they didn't do that either.
So how do we create something if there's no evidence of it?
You can't. It was their affirmative defense. They failed their burden. They put a tautological affidavit in saying we've tried. What does that mean?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've reserved almost 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Where to start? First, I urge you to look at the record of the trial court. Mr. Liggett went well beyond the record. He made a lot of statements today that I don't agree with, but more importantly, they're simply not in the record, and I don't believe are relevant. So I urge you, please look at the record. It's very sparse in the trial court. We did submit an affidavit indicating that we sought payment from the owner. And also,
how did you seek payment from the owner?
Well, there was a lawsuit that was filed, and again, Your Honor, this is outside the record, but there was a, because again, I would agree with Mr. Liggett at the time, we thought the issue was pay when paid versus pay if paid, and we thought that was determinative. If you look at the first page of the contract, there was an agreement between the prime contractor, which I believe is U.S. Aquatics, and AEM. AEM, or U.S. Aquatics, went after the owner, got a judgment in front of Judge Katz for, I think, several hundred thousand dollars and has been unable to collect. I talked to, I think, Han Loescher, Parks were the attorneys that pursued that claim, and they weren't unable to recover any money because the liens on the property by the banks are well beyond what the property's worth. So that's what it is. It's not in the record, and again, I would say it's not relevant. Again, where Mr. Liggett try to divert the attention was from the actual language. That's the key, the language of this agreement. And it's clear that it was unambiguous.
But do you agree that even if the language was understood, there was a meeting of the minds, there was the risk transfer there, there's still operative facts that could defeat that clause in the contract if the contractor failed to meet their obligation to go after the source of the money?
I think, yes, Your Honor, I think that's a critical point. And I would disagree that this is an affirmative defense by AEM. I think this is the burdens on Transtar to demonstrate there was a breach of contract. This is basic condition precedent law. And I think that if Transtar demonstrated that AEM, in bad faith, didn't pursue this claim, right, I would agree that would be something that might upset the condition precedent standard.
What if the record then demonstrates that AEM paid themselves their profit but didn't pay the sub? Wouldn't that be relevant here?
I agree. If they had done discovery and took depositions and put that in the record, I think that could be relevant. Yes, I completely agree. In fact, in this case, AEM was also, and it's set forth in the affidavit, wasn't paid by the owner.
But isn't that what the Court of Appeals has now directed happen in this case?
What the Court of Appeals, the fundamental difference with the Court of Appeals and the trial court is the Court of Appeals said, this is a pay when paid. Therefore, AEM, you owe. End of discussion. The only issue now is, right, when should have you paid? So that's what the Court of Appeals found. And obviously we're saying this is a pay if paid, end of discussion, owner didn't pay, AEM has no obligation to pay Transtar. And so what we're seeking is that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed.
But in fact, the owner did pay, what, 80% of the contract?
I think they paid, I think 40,000 wasn't paid and 100 and maybe 40,000 was paid.
And that just happened to be Transtar's bill to the contractor?
That happened.
40,000 that's missing?
No, the project didn't have any money. I mean, AEM didn't get paid its last invoices. Transtar didn't get paid its last invoices. U.S. Aquatics didn't get paid at the end either. I mean, there was multiple subs that didn't get paid at the end of this project. And Transtar is not alone. Everybody suffered the pain here, not just Transtar.
Transtar claims that they have a right under the contract to pursue that AEM is not permitting them to pursue litigation against the owner. What's your response to that claim?
Your Honor,
I heard that today. Is there a provision like that in the contract?
I am not aware. But I guess my response would be they would still have a claim for unjust enrichment. And second, they would still have a claim under 4113.62E, which allows them to pursue liens. And I guess my last response to that is that it's not really relevant. Again, this is agreed to contract language. Courts throughout the country have upheld and found that if you have this language.
If I understood Mr. Liggett's argument, he says there was no meeting of the minds on this because the contract is inconsistent and no contractor would agree to do the work and not get paid. What's your response to that position?
Well, I guess, first of all, I think the language is clear and unambiguous.
Pardon me, please?
I think the language is clear and unambiguous, and I've seen, when I was doing this research, I've seen articles saying that if you are a sub, be aware of this. If it's a pay if paid, strike it out if you can. So it's well known in the industry, and it is boilerplate, and some subcontractors can elect to cross it out and say, you know, if they lose a deal over that, that may be the case. But this is bargained for. This isn't a new concept. Subs are very aware of this provision, and they don't like it. I wouldn't like it if I was a sub, but if it's agreed to, it's agreed to.
So if, in essence, the Court of Appeals short-circuited an analysis of this contract under the paid, if paid, by simply going directly to an interpretation that this is a paid when paid, and therefore it's remanded to the trial court to figure out a time certain or, you know, what would be reasonable in the efforts to collect. But let's go back, and if we decide that this is a paid, if paid contract, the language is mutually understood, wasn't mutually understood, and it is sufficient to put both parties on notice that, this is a paid, if paid contract. There still is the failure to put forth the operative facts that may influence the your client's end of holding up this contract by, did they diligently attempt to collect on behalf of themselves and therefore the subcontractor? That to me is the missing component, and I'm wondering if we decide procedurally that we do uphold the paid if paid characteristics of this contract, in other words, find that clause valid, is there not further inquiry that needs to be made on the trial level as to the bad faith or good faith of your client?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I would submit that if you find it's paid, if paid, that judgment should be entered on behalf of AEM. And the reason I say that is because, again, it comes back to whose burden it is to establish whether AEM made appropriate or acted in good faith or bad faith in pursuing that. And I believe the burden, as it is in any condition precedent, is on Transtar. And so Transtar had that opportunity in the trial court to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we understand there could be a possibility of a condition precedent here, but we don't think that they were operating in good faith. So I think they had the opportunity to produce that evidence. They failed to do so.
That was never discussed at the trial court level.
No. Again, if you look at the record, it was very sparse. We submitted an affidavit.
So this was strictly done on motions, affidavits, and pleadings. There was never a hearing.
There was not a hearing. There was no depositions taken in this case. We think that our affidavit shows, you know, is sufficient to demonstrate that.
That you tried and it just couldn't be done.
Right.
And the only part of the contract that was at issue at the trial court was this specific language?
Right. Exactly. And since then, many other issues have been raised.
The other side did not bring in all these other things that Mr. Liggett talked about.
Not at all.
Okay.
No.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?
Thank you. All rise.